today on Against the Grain. How far would you go to stop the fossil fuel industry? What does bold and militant action in the face of climate calamity look like? I'm CS. A book by the veteran campaigner Chuck Collins considers these and other questions. He'll join us, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine. So wrote Henry David Thoreau. He was referring to injustice perpetrated, injustice legislated by government. Well, what if the machine is major polluters? What if the fossil fuel industry, its leaders, propagandists, and lobbyists, is the culprit? Must the movement to oppose the carbon oligarchs be nonviolent? What sorts of actions, collective and individual, should the movement encompass, embrace, or at least tolerate? Urgent questions like these populate a new book by the economic and environmental justice campaigner Chuck Collins, a staffer at the Institute for Policy Studies. The fact that the book is a work of fiction, it's Chuck's first novel, doesn't make it any less provocative. And in fact, it's packed with information about social movements past and present, about people, sometimes real people, who've made a huge difference. The book is Altar to an Erupting Sun. Chuck Collins directs the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's also a board member of the Post-Carbon Institute. When Chuck and I connected recently, I asked what Ray Kelleher, who has terminal cancer, what she does on Easter Sunday in the year 2023, and why it's not a spoiler to reveal this.
My main character, Ray Kelleher, gets up on Easter morning. She's one of these keepers of days, so she also knows it's the anniversary of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's execution, April 9th in 1945. So she's aware that this pacifist, in an attempt to assassinate Hitler, was executed for this attempted act of violence. And she drives down to Westchester County with her sort of adopted stepdaughter, Alex, and they, she essentially commits an act of kind of a suicide bombing, taking out the life of the CEO of a fossil fuel company who she believes is responsible for delaying society's response to climate change. And it's not a spoiler alert to talk about that right now, because that's really the first four pages of the book. It's meant to be a provocative beginning, and it's provocative in the sense of here's a person who you will learn has led a long life of nonviolent direct action, but at the very end of her life makes this shocking decision and action. And it really sets up this conversation, which is, you know, why did she do this? Why this act? And, what brought her over the her course of her lifetime to change her outlook on violence?
So she detonates a bomb and she kills this man and two family members, I believe. Tell us more about why she did it. She considers him somebody who needs to be basically eliminated because of the harm that he's doing.
Yeah, Ray believes that the CEO of this fossil fuel company used his considerable wealth and power over many decades to block alternatives, to delay action, to lobby against legislation that might have addressed climate change. She believes that people like this character, Brian Richardson, are going to face no consequences for this action. And, you know, over the last decade of her life, she's become more and more engaged in sort of understanding the climate crisis and climate disruption. And she starts to understand through her reading and studying and talking to people how this industry has used its clout in a way that's harmful to humanity, that they've, in her words, effectively poisoned the well, knowing that children are going to drink from that well. And she believes that they need to be held to account, and that as kind of her final act, that's what she wants to do as she exits her life.
Your character, your fictional character, Ray, believes that the fossil fuel barons' evil, the evil they are perpetrating, the evil that they are, is comparable to Hitler, as they are consciously destroying our one and only home, Mother Earth. That's a strong statement that we can leave there, unless you want to weigh in on Ray's belief, or perhaps weigh in on how other characters in your novel might weigh in.
Yeah, I think Ray has a strong feeling that, and she doesn't use the word evil, as her husband Reggie says. This is the only time she's ever used that word in his knowledge to apply to a human being. But she feels this is truly an act of evil, that these are people who understand the harm they're causing. You know, she's read the research about Shell and Exxon and how they knew decades ago about the harms caused by burning fossil fuels. She does give a clue that she's thinking about this, and pretty much everyone around her says that's a terrible idea. That's going to have a tremendous blowback. It's going to cause harms to the social movements that you care about. It's going to lead to a backlash against legitimate organizing around climate change. You know, you're going to be labeled a terrorist, and that's going to lead to a crackdown and civil liberties, all of which, you know, in the future fiction part of the book, somewhat come to pass. So she's surrounded by people who essentially are telling her it's a bad idea. But in the final act, she goes forward on her own.
Reggie, who is Ray's husband, is asked by a number of people, how does someone, Ray, with a lifelong commitment to nonviolence, someone basically shaped by nonviolence, do what she did? And your book does seem like an attempt to answer that question. It goes back into her life and traces many of the people she's met, the social movements she's participated in. There's a broad history of very interesting activism and organizing. How do we begin to talk about Ray's commitment to nonviolence? What are some of the contours of that? In what ways was she not only exposed to nonviolent activism, but an active participant in it?
The book is a formation story, and she's effectively formed by elders, people who actually are real people in some cases, Wally and Juanita Nelson, who are anti-war pacifists and civil rights activists. She learns about nonviolent direct action in a practical way. She joins an effort called the Clamshell Alliance to try to keep a nuclear power plant from being built. Later, she's involved in efforts to try to shut down the School of Americas, a military training facility in Georgia that trains, you know, Central American military people to oppress their own people, in her view. She is involved in direct action efforts to try to stop the construction of a pipeline. In each of these cases, she's not just a participant, she is a trainer. She is steeped in nonviolent direct action. She kind of is watching all the tactics around her, including people who've take their own life through self-immolation in opposition to the Vietnam War. She's watching and absorbing and reflecting on strategies for social change, and that sort of comes through her life experience. And in some ways, it makes it all the more unusual, her decision at the end of her life to take another life, to commit an act of violence, when she's so deeply steeped in these nonviolent traditions.
Do you think her action, her last act, so to speak, was guided by a sense of urgency, a sense that there was really no other way to effectively begin to stop the climate criminals, she might call them? And what does that say then about her attachment to social movements, collective organizing, the idea that you can build over time enough pressure on individuals and the system to actually hopefully stop their activities, stop their, in this case, planet-destroying activities.
Yeah, I think I try to set the stage by trying to get into Ray's state of mind in these final years of her life. She is seeing how the powerful fossil fuel industry has kind of captured the political system, how the political system appears incapable of responding in a timely way to the urgency of the climate crisis. She is also feeling her own body, that she's lived a healthy life, but she sort of feels like there's almost sort of an attack on her body as well. She thinks about the chemical industries and the exposure she's had. She's sort of kind of, you know, losing her grip a little bit at the end of her life. But at the same time, she's very savvy about understanding that the society is sleepwalking toward the precipice here, and that something dramatic is required. And when she floats the idea of taking her own life and the life of a fossil fuel executive, her husband Reggie says, you know, that's a terrible idea. And later he says, well, what about something dramatic like a self-immolation? Do what Norman Morrison, a Quaker pacifist, did during the Vietnam War. Take your own life in the lobby of ExxonMobil. And she says, no, that's not going to be dramatic enough. So she's sort of thinking as a political strategist about this distracted moment we're in, where, you know, we're just really unable to face the future and face the situation, and that the powerful industries are using their power to block all alternatives. And it's interesting, you know, watching the most recent United Nations COP meeting, you know, COP28 about climate change, and looking at the thousands of fossil fuel lobbyists who came there effectively to water down and block the urgent responses that are needed. So, you know, if Ray were alive and watching this situation, she would sort of say, yeah, we really have to focus attention on these decision makers, these powerful individuals who are calling the shots here, and hold them to account.
Chuck Collins joins me on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. He is a campaigner and storyteller who's worked for decades on environmental and economic justice campaigns. He works at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs the program on inequality and the common good. We are talking about his novel, his first novel called Altar to an Erupting Sun. It's published by Green Writers Press. This focus on individual accountability, Chuck, does this analysis by Ray, in your opinion, leave out or evade a systemic view of things, that, you know, we have to look beyond the individuals to see how the system operates?
Yeah, I think very much the conversation and the debate that Reggie and Ray have is over this, you know, Reggie saying, look, this is a systemic problem. It's deeply embedded in our form of capitalism and economy. There are whole chains of actors. And what Ray says is, yes, but individuals are accountable. There are powerful people who are reading the science and are making decisions to invest in disinformation campaigns. There are powerful propagandists and think tanks and researchers who actually are cooking the data and trying to diminish and confuse the science. And there are lobbyists who are being directed by large corporations and individuals in those corporations to oppose alternative energies or go to the COP28 meeting to oppose a resolution saying we must phase out fossil fuels. So Ray is kind of saying, you know, yeah, it's a system, but there are individuals operating in that system who are powerful and should be held to account, and we should be, their pictures should be on wanted posters, and we should have tribunals that look at when did they know and how did they act and how did they use their power and resources. This is more me now talking, saying we're at a stage of the social movement where we really should be looking at who are the individuals who should be held to account. You know, if 20 years from now there's a Nuremberg climate crimes tribunal, who are the people that will be called forward to testify and be held accountable? That's kind of what's certainly in my mind now, is the absence of that. You know, do we know the names of the 25 most powerful fossil fuel industry leaders who have brought us to this point and have kind of run out the clock in terms of our options? I don't think we know that.
So as you mentioned, Ray, the main character in your new novel, Altar to an Erupting Sun, by my guest Chuck Collins, she interacts with a number of people who are real people. Now, obviously, you're fictionalizing them, like their actions and what they say to her, but they are people, and often cases, really important people in and famous people in social movements over the last many decades. In 1984, Ray falls in love with Brian Wilson, who led Vietnam Veterans Against the War in the 1970s. Why do you have your character meet him? What motivated you to bring him in, especially for, I take it, some of the ideas he could share, some of the experiences he could share with Ray?
There's part of me that was interested in, I guess I would call it, social movement history, and lifting up some real figures and real stories of people who have, I think, done really interesting things. So Brian Wilson, actually I knew Brian Wilson briefly when he was the head of a veterans organization in Greenfield, Massachusetts. And I remember him being very obsessed with this person, Norman Morrison, who I mentioned is a Quaker who set himself on fire outside the offices of Robert McNamara. And then Brian himself, you know, sat on train tracks, you know, outside Oakland, California, to block a train of munitions that were taking weapons to Central America. And the train didn't stop, and it ran over his legs. He almost was killed. So he engaged in a sacrificial act of nonviolent direct action. And, you know, my hope a little bit, like good historical fiction, my experience is I read a history and I think, oh, I want to learn more about the real history here. I hope that when people read Altar to an Erupting Sun, they'll say, well, who was Sam Lovejoy? Did he really topple that tower trying to stop that nuclear power plant? And who is Juanita Nelson? Is she a, you know, civil rights activist who went back to the land, who believes in nonviolent war tax resistance? And who is Brian Wilson? So yeah, there's part of my hope is that people will want to learn more about these real historical figures who are on my own altar, if you will. You know, the book is called Altar to an Erupting Sun, but it is sort of an altar to real people and social movements that have shaped the world that we live in.
Ray helped organize nonviolent direct action trainers for the Clamshell Alliance. Remind us what the Clamshell Alliance, founded in 1976 to oppose the construction of the Seabrook nuclear power plant in New Hampshire. So it was very New England focused. But what should we know about Clamshell Alliance and the impact it had?
In the mid-70s, all across the U.S., there were grassroots local anti-nuclear power groups that sprang up. There was a proposal to build a huge double reactor in Seabrook, New Hampshire, on the coast of New England. And the Clamshell Alliance formed with a commitment to nonviolently stop the construction of the power plant. It had already sort of gotten all the approvals, but these were people from all the New England states who formed affinity groups and engaged in, you know, occupations of the site. And all across the country, there were sort of similar movements, you know, the Diablo Alliance out in the Bay Area and others. So there, you know, they were part of this grassroots citizens movement. And one of the things that really did happen, which is These groups were organizing on the ground, trying to educate the public and wake up the public about the dangers of nuclear power and nuclear waste. And then all of a sudden, you know, 1978, 79, Three Mile Island, there's an accident. And these movements are there. They're positioned well to push back and essentially stop the construction of and licensing of any new power plants going forward. And for Ray, it's an example of success and the importance of social movements being prepared. And a lot of people think, oh, well, all this work and education and organizing I'm doing doesn't really have an impact. I'm feeling discouraged. But what Ray learned in that moment was you do all that work and you do that preparation, and sometimes things happen like an accident or another kind of dramatic public event, and all of a sudden you're ready as a social movement. So it was really a lesson in her own understanding that things take time and that sometimes the more invisible efforts, the not as sometimes rewarding public actions are important to prepare us for whatever's coming down the path.
At one point, Juanita Nelson quotes Thoreau. She says, "Let your life be a counter friction to stop the machine," by which she means?
Yeah, that nonviolent action isn't just sort of passively sitting there. Sometimes it is applying the brake or slowing the action or engaging directly in putting your body, in some cases, in front of the machine. You know, it's a famous Thoreau quote. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German theologian, says you have to put your spoke, stick in the spoke of the wheel of oppression. Again, another metaphor for you're not just standing by, you're not being a bystander, you're actively engaging in stopping a harmful behavior.
Yeah, Chuck, your novel, Altar to an Erupting Sun, I mean, it's full of people who are just so committed, who think and live politically, right? It's an everyday practice for these people. She's, you know, when they sit down and have breakfast together, they're talking about what's going on in Central America or with the nuclear industry or any number of injustices. And you are a deeply political person, of course. You have worked for years and years at the Institute for Policy Studies. You've engaged with issues about inequality. You've written books about the wealth hoarders. You've written books with other people like Bill Gates Sr. You wrote Wealth in Our Commonwealth. What level of inspiration do you take from people who seem to devote all of their time and energy to trying to save the planet, to trying to save innocent people? I mean, it just is. Do you see that as just some sort of incredibly exceptional or extraordinary way of life? Or do you think it's something that is accessible to the rest of us, something that, you know, we can all, or that we should strive to be?
One of the things I felt inspired to do with this novel was depict people who were lifelong activists. And I don't see a lot of fiction that depicts people who do that. And I do try to balance out in the story. One of the things that happens is Ray and Reggie move back to the land. You know, they call themselves late in life back to the landers. They form a community in a rural area, and they celebrate a lot too. They figure out ways to sing and have parties and grow food together and engage in rituals. So it's not all just serious activism, but it's all rooted in the sense of how do they create a life that enables them to make a difference. And so I do think it's important, and I think it's important to have examples of people young and old who are making those kind of lifelong commitments and not just getting discouraged when one campaign fizzles out and they understand it's a longer-term process.
Chuck Collins joins me on Against the Grain. He co-edits inequality.org. That's a program of the Institute for Policy Studies. He's co-founder of Divest invest.org. It's a global movement to divest from fossil fuels and invest in climate solutions. He's got a novel out, his first novel. It's called Altar to an Erupting Sun. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm C.S. Song. Yeah, and you were talking about Ray and her husband, Reggie, going back to the land. So they moved from Boston to Vermont when they were in their late 50s. Talk more about why they made that move. I mean, they were very active in the Boston area, in social movements. So they were doing a lot of sort of collective action. But yeah, part of this novel seems to be that Ray, for example, she just wasn't just attracted to collective organizing. She was attracted to collective living.
Yeah, I think that part of Ray's understanding of the climate crisis, too, is the need to build community resilience, to create communities of mutual aid and support as a way to face the future. So she's interested in the bigger system change campaign work, but she's also really interested in place-based community building, growing food, creating livelihoods rooted in place. So it's part of her view. She did grow up in a small rural Midwestern community where she and her brother could run around in the woods. So she and she loved living in Western Mass. So for her, it was a return back to a simpler rural life rooted in a rural community.
A section of your book is called Accompaniment. What does accompaniment mean in the context of activism in relation to Central America? And what does Ray think of accompaniment?
In the 1980s, Ray was part of the social movements of people, some of whom went to Nicaragua or El Salvador to participate in solidarity work. And I think at one point she even says to a friend of hers who's a Roman Catholic priest, she says, "Boy, you know, shouldn't we have just sent money? Isn't it a waste of resources to have, you know, 75 of us here picking cotton? We're terrible at picking cotton." And he says, "Well, the point here is to accompany these folks in their struggle for liberation. You can't do their work for them, but you can accompany them." And it became a kind of a principle of for Ray's life and an understanding of solidarity movements generally. Sometimes you can't fix the problem, and this might be true even with a loved one who's facing an illness. You can't necessarily heal them or make them better, but you can accompany them in their struggle. And so for Ray, that becomes an operative principle, that you can't always fix everything, but showing up, being present, is a form of solidarity, is part of how social change happens.
Yeah, Ray's internationalist focus really comes through in this book. I know you share it. Ray saw consumption and energy use in rich nations, like the U.S., as a form of imperial conquest. What was her rationale behind that statement?
You know, Ray grew up in Ohio, a working-class family, didn't have an opportunity to travel much. So, you know, in her late 20s, she's in Central America, and she kind of viscerally understands the level of consumption differences, and that so much of the world economy is oriented around supplying goods and food and to those of us who live in the United States and the global north. So she sort of gets a very deep understanding that the inequality of consumption, the sort of history of colonialism and the exploitation of whole regions of the equator and the south are to satisfy the consumption needs of the United States. So she kind of gets that picture, and it informs her. So, you know, later when she's thinking about energy consumption and fossil fuel consumption, she's thinking, well, we in the United States have a huge responsibility. Our standard of living has been built on consuming the world's resources, you know, 5% of the population using half the world's resources. Is not a sustainable situation. In fact, it's a exploitative and violent arrangement.
Part of Ray's spiritual practice was, I'm reading here, being comfortable with uncomfortable conditions. What does that mean?
You know, Ray is a little bit, you could call her an ascetic. She's not focused on making everything cozy, comfortable, convenient for herself. She actually thinks that's part of the problem of our kind of affluent Northern Hemisphere standard of living. She wouldn't say that's true about everybody. She knows poverty. She's raised in without a lot of money. But she would sort of say, why sort of focus on all of us being comfortable all the time, emotionally and physically? So it was more of her own quiet code of living. She didn't necessarily impose that on others. In fact, Reggie at one point says, you know, Ray really believed in hospitality. You know, if you came to visit CS, she would want you to feel comfortable in our home, you know, and take care of you and your needs. But the focus on comfort in the culture goes too far.
Just to remind folks that Ray is Ray Kelleher, who is one of the main characters of Chuck Collins' new novel, Altar to an Erupting Sun. And the novel, as we mentioned earlier, begins with a literal bang. It is Ray carrying off a suicide bombing where she kills herself and a fossil fuel executive. And as Chuck made clear, not all the characters, in fact, very few characters in this book, agree with what Ray did. And much of the book is about trying to understand why someone so committed to nonviolence over many decades of social movement activism would do such a thing. So the community that Ray and her husband Reggie join in Vermont is called the Hidden River Farm. And at that farm, at this intentional community, Ray convened the Hospice and Green Burial Ministry. What prompted her to do that?
Ray and is not alone in this, but Ray is interested in sort of end of life and sort of changing the culture around death and dying. She actually at some point sort of alludes to the fact that part of our inability to face the future is our death phobia, our inability to recognize we're part of a great cycle, that things come to an end and die and regenerate. And she's part of this culture shift. For instance, at the farm, they actually create a forest burial ground. So instead of a cemetery, people, when they die, have a green burial in a forest where their remains join the, what she says, the wood wide web, you know, get plugged back into the decomposition cycle. So she has this pastoral interest in helping people think through their final stages of life. So, you know, and they're also trying to figure out how to earn money and have livelihoods in their new community. And so they identify this as kind of a niche that maybe they can help people organize end-of-life rituals, think proactively. And so she is essentially a death doula. She works with people at the end of their life. And they form a whole, you know, four or five of the members of the community are partly employed through this project that they have, including a young woman who weaves coffins out of willow branches and creates kind of ecological coffins. So part of my interest in a writer was sort of to lift up some of the interesting things that I see emerging and imagine them, you know, over the next 10 years, how they might grow. And one of them is definitely the sort of alternative approaches to death and dying.
And you included this as part of describing Ray's life, of creating Ray's life in your mind. You included this because you believe that, along with Ray, that our cultural attitudes toward death and dying are part of what keeps our society from facing the realities of climate change?
And my own life experiences, I have seen how other cultures address death and dying. For instance, you know, I've spent time in Mexico. I've been around sort of the Day of the Dead rituals and sort of the perspective that, you know, our ancestors are still with us. Day of the Dead, that time of year, whether it's the Celtic tradition or the Mexican tradition or a lot of global traditions, there are times of the year when you can have a little easier line of communication with the other side, with the ancestors. And Ray loves to organize those gatherings. So, yeah, I think it's a recognition that our culture is somewhat unique in our denial about death and our death phobia, the fact that you can't talk about it and you can't really plan around it. And we, you know, medical intervention in the final year of life is excessive and usually unnecessary. And helping people kind of choose how they want their final years and days to be. And Ray thinks that's a radical thing, a radical act. And in her own decision, obviously, she decides she's not going to go quietly, but it was part of her overall understanding of, you know, live how you want to, die how you want to live. Die how you want to live. And don't necessarily give yourself over to the medical industry. She at the end of her life, she learns she's facing down terminal illness. She doesn't have long to live. And she walks away from all the hospital offerings. She explores it. She looks into it. She talks to the doctors and then makes this decision, which is, I'm not going to go down that path. So again, she is modeling a different way of thinking about death and dying.
Altars play a significant role in this novel. In fact, altar is a word in the title of your novel, Altar to an Erupting Sun. What sorts of altars exist or are created in this novel, and what is their significance? And I can't resist asking you whether you have an altar.
Well, I think most of us are familiar now with, you know, sort of the Mexican Day of the Dead tradition and the idea that you build an altar and you honor the people who've died, and you sort of have a remembrance ritual. And, you know, I lived in Oaxaca, Mexico in 2005, 2006, so I was steeped and exposed to it. And I definitely am an altar builder, you know, and especially that time of year, and particularly when I lose someone important in my life, I like to have a private altar. It's not a public community altar. It's just my own altar of photos and memories. And, you know, to light a candle and to sit with that is a practice I find useful. And as somebody who's doesn't have Mexican heritage, I've learned that, well, actually, within the Celtic tradition and within lots of traditions, traditional societies around the world, many of us can find altar building and remembrance rituals and, you know, calling to the ancestors. Those are all very much part of our human experience. And Ray, she's kind of like the life of the party in many ways, including the life of the altar building. She organizes big public rituals around Samhain, or which is the Celtic holiday that also lines up with Halloween and Day of the Dead and All Saints and All Souls, that time in early November, late October. And in the Celtic tradition, that's the thin time. That's the time when the permeability between this life and the other lives is you can cross through that boundary and communicate across those boundaries. So yeah, Ray is the builder of community altars as well as private, personal altars. When you're in a particular stage of grief, to have a private altar is very, very important and powerful. So yeah, it's a tradition that I see more and more people engaged in that tradition. And some of my readers, one of the big takeaways of reading the book was, oh, I want to create an altar building practice, or I already sort of have an altar building practice. I didn't even call it that. I'm going to be more intentional about that.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Chuck Collins joins me, veteran environmental and economic justice campaigner. He's got a new novel out. It's called Altar to an Erupting Sun. So much of this novel does take place in this rural community in Vermont, this intentional community. I don't know whether you'd call it an eco-village. I think you would. people coming together. I mean, it sounds idyllic in many respects, although, of course, you know, you have people coming together. There will be disagreements and conflicts, things to iron out. There's a conversation in this novel about people fleeing cities, especially coastal cities slammed by hurricanes right on the Atlantic coast. And Reggie, Ray's husband, says the future is rural. Do you personally agree with this?
You know, I'm involved in an organization called the Post Carbon Institute that actually did a report called The Future is Rural. And it's a really interesting perspective, which is, you know, we've migrated to cities and we've built up tremendous concentrations of population, largely based on access to cheap energy, fossil fuel energy. If you look at our modern cities, how dependent they are on food importation, energy from outside, air conditioning, huge amounts of electricity, and almost unlimited energy consumption. And if you look at where we need to go over the next 15, 20 years, where do we need to be? We probably need to deconcentrate population, particularly in coastal cities that are going to experience sea level rise. And more of us need to be closer to, you know, food production and access to land for living and our basic needs. So I think there is something to that. I personally wrestle with that as somebody who, you know, loves living in vibrant cities and has most of my life. But I think there's something to be learned from that. The whole idea that you can live in a place where you import 97% of your calories coming on fossil fuel infrastructure may not be viable going forward. I'm not one of those people who thinks we're going to have like a sort of techno fix of the future, that somebody's going to invent something and we're all just going to keep living the way we live now. I think we're not going to be able to live the way we live now, particularly those of us in the global north who've been consuming the most in terms of energy and resources. So yeah, I think we need to think about how do we decentralize. Now, there's a lot we can do in cities to make them, you know, more food independent, less energy dependent. But, you know, the idea of millions of people living within small areas may not be as viable when you take all that cheap, easy to get energy out of the picture.
So a dear friend of Ray's named Alex, right, sort of an adopted stepdaughter, you said, says she thought Ray's action, this suicide bombing that killed Ray, of course, and also an oil executive, a fossil fuel executive, was wrong, but then says, Ray's question to us would be, if you don't like what I did, if you consider me a murderer, then what will you do to stop the Brian Richardsons of the world, Brian Richardson being the CEO that she killed, from their direct assault on Mother Earth? What will you do that is more effective? For Ray, this is still Alex speaking, the intimately personal question became, how do you stop the maniac determined to poison the village well? That question, Ray's question, is that the question we all need to ask, do you think?
Well, I think Alex's question or her message from Ray is, what bold action are each of us going to take to shift the trajectory? You know, we're essentially hurtling toward a ecological cliff. What are each of us called to do? And what does bold action look like? So I think she's talking about, you know, what does it look like to escalate tactics? And this is something I think we're going to see more of. There's a group called Climate Defiance, which is, you know, showing up and disrupting events with government and private sector leaders who are culpable in climate change. There's more focus on who is the fossil fuel industry? How do we particularly look at the power of that industry? And what does that look like? There's a part of the book which is a bit of a future fiction looking ahead over the next 7-8 years. And one of the things that happens is six grandmothers calling themselves the good ancestors self-immolate themselves in the lobby of a American Petroleum Institute or something, some big fossil fuel company. And that action sort of breaks through in a way that maybe Ray's violent action, which was dismissed as a terrorist act, there was something about this sacrificial act that these elders took. I think we're, to be honest, I think that's where we're at. We're going to be seeing more bold and militant action in defense of the earth. I'm not advocating what Ray Kelleher did or violence, but I think we're going to have to figure out how to, in the words of Thoreau, you know, how do you put friction against the machine? And in this case, the machine is the fossil fuel industry, which is working very hard to slow down and delay any society response to climate change. How do we, you know, put a stick in the wheel of that industry? So I think we are in this moment. We are looking at a rogue industry that has captured our political system. So you can't look to Washington, D.C. in the way maybe we could for some other issues. The industry has rigged and wired the game so effectively, we're going to have to use every other tool at our disposal to shift things. And I think, you know, what I tried to do in the novel is show here's like a wide range of the way people are trying to think about social change, and also how do you prepare where you live for climate disruption. We're not going to stop the worst effects of climate change. At this point, we're on a trajectory to blow past, you know, 1.5 degrees centigrade of global warming. That's going to, you know, cause all kind of disruption. We had a disruptive summer, you know, and we're going to probably see more of that. We are going to see more of that in the years to come. So what are each of us called to do? What does bold action look like in this moment for you, for me, as we face the future together?
And regardless of what opinion one might harbor about what Ray does at the beginning of this novel, the suicide bombing, the question that rises in this book, what could a decentralized army of terminally ill people do, is sort of provocative and interesting. I want to end by asking you what you think needs to be done with and to the fossil fuel oligarchs and the oligarchy. What you know, in your vision, if anything could really happen, be done to these people, what do you think is the proper course of action?
You know, I think that there's a lot of pressure points where we can come together and make a difference. We need to start with understanding the role of the fossil fuel industry, how they have historically used their power to fund disinformation and cloud the science and delay. And the fact that you and I can't take a high-speed train from San Francisco to Los Angeles in part is because the power of the fossil fuel industry has lobbied against alternatives. The reason you can't go out and buy an affordable car that's an all-electric vehicle today is because the fossil fuel industry has used their power to block it. So understand and learn that history. Learn who the people who are responsible, who they are, and how to hold them account. I'm part of a research project. We call it the Climate Accountability Research Project, CARP, looking at who are the climate criminals, so that next time you go to a protest on climate change, you have a sign that says, here's one of the people who's responsible. We should look at all the enablers, the financial industries, the large global banks that provide financing for new fossil fuel projects. And we should do everything we can to stop new fossil fuel infrastructure. And that includes direct action against pipelines, expansions of airports. In the area where I live, I'm part of a fight to try to stop an airport from tripling its private jet capacity. You know, ultra-rich people flying private jets is not a good use of fossil fuel on a warming planet. So there are all these pressure points, and I think it's finding how to align your own personal calling and gifts with the pressure points that matter. And support groups like Climate Defiance and Third Act, which is people in their later years, you know, taking risks for bold action on climate change. Join the groups that are working for climate justice and sustainability and equitable, racially equitable transition to a different kind of economy. So again, what we do today in the next couple of years, this is the critical decade to act, will really affect the trajectory of the next couple generations. And so it's time for us to roll up our sleeves and find our piece of that work and get bold and fearless in terms of facing the future.
Which, Chuck, I know is why you set your novel in a way that it begins not in the far future, but on Easter Day in 2023, and it ends in 2030. So this is a near future novel. It's called Altar to an Erupting Sun. My guest and the author is Chuck Collins. He's a campaigner and storyteller who's worked for decades on environmental and economic justice campaigns. He directs the program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's active with inequality.org, which he co-edits, divestinvest.org, resilience.org, and the Post Carbon Institute. Chuck, congratulations on your new, very thought-provoking novel, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, CS, for having me and for this conversation.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.